This is tape one, side two, of the book, The Baha'i Faith, continuing from page 24. During the years in Baghdad, verses streamed from the pen of Baha'u'llah. The Book of Certitude, his major theological work, was written in the space of 2 days and two nights. In Baghdad, he wrote The Hidden Words, a short but compelling book of spiritual guidance, and The Seven Valleys, a mystical work written in response to questions from the Sufi mystics. With a mandate from the Shah, a concourse of Muslim leaders in Baghdad, jealous of his growing influence, tried to discredit him and asked him to perform a miracle that would satisfy all concerned. Page 25. Baha'u'llah agreed to perform any miracle they asked, but they could not agree on which to request, and his challenge was never taken up. The Iranian consul in Baghdad, alarmed at Baha'u'llah's growing fame, began to agitate for his further banishment. He obtained an order of banishment. The governor of Baghdad admired Baha'u'llah greatly, and it was only after 5 successive orders of banishment had reached him that he reluctantly informed Baha'u'llah that the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire had ordered Baha'u'llah's transfer to Constantinople. The announcement of Baha'u'llah's banishment caused uproar in the city. Hundreds of people crowded into the streets around his house, weeping and lamenting his departure. The crush became so great that Baha'u'llah moved out of the city to a garden on the far side of the river. He stayed there for 12 days, cheering and encouraging his followers. Many of them knew intuitively that he was the one of whom the Bab had spoken, but Baha'u'llah had never spoken to anyone of his mission. Here in the Garden of Rizwan, he made a formal declaration to some of his followers that he was indeed him whom God shall make manifest, transforming their great sorrow into joy. Page 26. This public announcement that he was the promised one of all religions, that his faith was for all mankind, and that a new day had dawned in human history, lasted for a period of 12 days from 21 April to 2 May, 1863. It became known as the Festival of Rizwan, commemorated annually throughout the Baha'i world as the holiest and most significant of all Baha'i festivals. No fewer than 3 of the 9 Baha'i holy days occurred during this Rizwan festival. Exile in Turkey. Baha'u'llah's journey of exile to Constantinople, Istanbul, was a triumphal procession. He was respectfully met and courteously entertained by the officials and notables of the towns and villages through which he passed. In Constantinople, his government's ambassador to the city was urged by his rulers in Tehran to stir up hostility against the exiles, and the ambassadors painted a picture of Baha'u'llah as a proud and arrogant person who had no respect for law and who was working to destroy the Ottoman Empire regime. When Baha'u'llah had been only 4 months in Constantinople, the Iranian and Ottoman rulers cooperated to secure yet another exile. An order was issued demanding his immediate removal to Adrianople, Edirne. It was December and the coldest winter in living memory. Baha'u'llah, his family, and his companions had to make a hurried departure without adequate provisions. They traveled in rain and storm across a bleak and windswept landscape. The journey took 12 days. They had to make several night marches and arrived in a state of exhaustion. Baha'u'llah spent 5 years in Adrianople. He was, by this time, officially a prisoner of the Ottoman Empire, but no charge was brought against him. In Adrianople, the faith underwent a severe internal crisis, caused by the jealousy of Baha'u'llah's brother, Mirza Yahya, and another man named Sayyid Muhammad. It was Mirza Yahya who had been jealous of Baha'u'llah in Baghdad, and who had created difficulties in Constantinople. He had now become so consumed with jealousy that he tried to kill Baha'u'llah by poisoning his food. Baha'u'llah was made very ill by the poison and suffered from the effects of it for the rest of his life. While in Adrianople, Baha'u'llah formally proclaimed his mission to the kings and rulers of the world and its religious leaders. Here and later in Akka, he wrote individual letters to the monarchs of Europe in which he called on them to recognize his faith. Page 27. He also urged them to settle the differences that divided them, to reduce their armaments, and take better care of their people. In a letter from Akka to Queen Victoria, Baha'u'llah wrote, "That which the Lord hath ordained as the sovereign remedy and mightiest instrument for the healing of all the world is the union of all its peoples in one universal cause, one common faith. This can in no wise be achieved except through the power of a skilled, an all-powerful and inspired physician." It is related that Queen Victoria's comment on reading the letter was, "If this is of God, it will endure. If not, no harm can come of it." The mission of Baha'u'llah, revealed to him in the Sea of Chal, Tehran, but kept concealed for 10 years, had been publicly announced in the Rizwan Garden, Baghdad, and was now, in the middle of 1868, being proclaimed individually and collectively to the then rulers of the world: Napoleon III, Tsar of Russia, William I of Prussia, Franz Joseph of Austria, Pope Pius IX, the Sultan of Turkey, and the Shah of Iran were all addressed by Baha'u'llah during his proclamation. It was during this period in Adrianople that the Baha'i greeting Allahu Akbar, God is all glorious, came into use, and the followers of Baha'u'llah became known as Baha'is. The Baha'is in Iran and Iraq were bitterly persecuted, and many were killed, but the movement continued to spread. Some of the Baha'is traveled from Iran and Iraq to Adrianople in the hope of seeing Baha'u'llah. The Turkish authorities in Adrianople treated Baha'u'llah with great respect. This did not please the Iranian consul in the city. Mirza Yahya and Sayyid Muhammad assisted the consul in his task of ensuring a further banishment for Baha'u'llah. They sent false accusations to the capital of the Ottoman Empire, Constantinople, accusing Baha'u'llah of plotting to overthrow the Ottoman regime. The governor of Adrianople, who held Baha'u'llah in great esteem, several times denied these accusations in writing, but the central authorities eventually sent an order of banishment. One morning, Baha'u'llah's house was surrounded by soldiers, and the inhabitants of the city, Christian and Muslim, wept openly in the streets as the orders were read out. Several consuls of foreign powers resident in Adrianople offered to intercede on behalf of the exiles, but Baha'u'llah declined these offers of help. Page 28. Banishment to the Holy Land. Soldiers escorted the exiles from Adrianople to Gallipoli. No one knew their final destination or what was planned for them. At Gallipoli, orders were issued that Baha'u'llah and his followers, together with a few of the followers of Mirza Yahya, were to be sent to prison in Akka, while four of Baha'u'llah's followers were to go to Cyprus with Mirza Yahya and his companions. As they left Gallipoli, Baha'u'llah warned his followers that the journey ahead of them would be worse than anything they had yet encountered. He advised anyone who did not feel strong enough to face it to leave at once, as they would be unable to leave later. No one left. Akka was a penal colony in a remote corner of the Ottoman Empire. The worst criminals from all parts of the empire were sent there. The water and air of Akka were foul, and the place was overrun with vermin and full of disease. It was said of Akka that if a bird flew over the city, so putrid was the air that it would fall down dead. The sea journey to Akka was one of miserable discomfort. At Haifa, Mirza Yahya and his companions in exile left the main party. Page 29. On arrival at Akka on 31 August 1868, the exiles were met by a hostile crowd of townspeople who had been told that the Baha'is were the vilest and most despicable criminals. The crowd hurled stones and insults and spat on the prisoners. The edict of perpetual banishment imposed on Baha'u'llah and his followers was read aloud from the steps of the mosque as a warning to the townspeople to have nothing to do with the prisoners. The order was one of strict imprisonment. The Baha'is were forbidden to associate with each other or with the townspeople. Baha'u'llah himself was confined in a mud-floored cell that was open to wind and rain, while the rest of the party were crowded into a few rooms nearby. On the first night in prison, they were given no food or drink. All except two fell ill with malaria and dysentery, and three died. The Baha'is in Iran and elsewhere did not know where Baha'u'llah was or even if he was still alive. When news reached them, some set out on foot for the prison city. At first they could not get into the city, but stood for hours and sometimes days beyond the second moat in the hope of glimpsing Baha'u'llah at the cell window. Some brought plants with them, refusing to drink the little water they carried across the desert and saving it for the plants. They made a garden with these flowers outside the city. Mirza Mehdi, Baha'u'llah's second son, fell through an unguarded skylight in the prison roof and died as a result of the injuries he sustained. His last request to his father was that his own life might be accepted as a ransom for those who were unable to get access into the prison. A few months later, the prison accommodation was needed by the Turkish army. The exiles were moved out into a house in the city where they were kept in very crowded conditions. Gradually, however, the changes that had taken place in Baghdad, Constantinople, and Adrianople began to occur in Acre. The prison governor, the officials of the town, and the town's people began to recognize Baha'u'llah's innocence and his exceptional qualities. Abdu'l-Bahá, Baha'u'llah's eldest son, who took upon himself the work of Baha'u'llah's household affairs, was a loved and respected figure. The governor of the prison sent his own son to Abdu'l-Bahá for his education. This governor wished to render some act of service for Baha'u'llah, who suggested that he rebuild the town's aqueduct, which had been in disrepair for 30 years. When Baha'u'llah had been 9 years in the city, the edict of perpetual banishment was completely ignored by the prison governor and the officials. Page 30. Abdu'l-Bahá rented a pleasant house outside the city for his father, and Baha'u'llah, who had not seen trees and flowers growing for 9 years, moved out of the city. 2 years later, a spacious mansion which had just been completed at Baji was rented by Abdu'l-Bahá, and it was in that mansion that Baha'u'llah spent the last 13 years of his earthly life. When the day-to-day administration of affairs in Abdu'l-Bahá's hands, Baha'u'llah was free to devote his time to writing. He rarely gave personal interviews, but his influence was widely felt, and the rulers of Palestine envied his power and influence. Professor E. G. Brown, a distinguished Orientalist from Cambridge, spent 5 days at Baji and has left this account of an interview with Baha'u'llah. In the corner where the divan met the wall sat a wondrous and venerable figure. The face of him on whom I gazed I can never forget, though I cannot describe it. Those piercing eyes seemed to read one's very soul. Power and authority sat on that ample brow, while the deep lines on the forehead and face implied an age which the jet-black hair and beard flowing down in indistinguishable luxuriance, almost to the waist, seemed to belie. No need to ask in whose presence I stood, as I bowed myself before one who was the object of a devotion and love which kings might envy and emperors sigh for in vain. A mild, dignified voice bade me be seated, and then continued, "Praise be to God that thou hast attained. Thou hast come to see a prisoner and an exile. We desire but the good of the world and the happiness of the nations, yet they deem us a stirrer up of strife and sedition, worthy of bondage and banishment. That all nations should become one in faith and all men as brothers, that the bonds of affection and unity between the sons of men should be strengthened, that diversity of religion should cease, and differences of race be annulled. What harm is there in this? Yet so it shall be. These fruitless strifes, these ruinous wars, shall pass away, and the most great peace shall come. Do not you in Europe need this also? Is not this what Christ foretold? Yet do we see your kings and rulers lavishing their treasures more freely on means for the destruction of the human race than on that which would conduce to the happiness of mankind. These strifes and this bloodshed and discord must cease, and all men be as one kindred and one family. Page 31. Let not a man glory in this, that he loves his country. Let him rather glory in this, that he loves his kind. Baha'u'llah visited Haifa 4 times in the last years of his life, and pitched his tent on Mount Carmel. He pointed out to Abdu'l-Bahá a piece of land on the rocky hillside where the remains of the Bab should be buried. There are gardens on the hillside now, green lawns and avenues of shady cypresses surrounding a beautiful building of white marble under which the remains of the Bab and his young companion were laid to rest. Page 32. On 29 May 1892, Baha'u'llah's earthly life ended. The bells of Acre, which 24 years earlier had warned the people of the coming of the exile, tolled out his passing, and a multitude of people walked out to the mansion at Baji and wept bitterly. There was a week of mourning, during which the notables and government officials paid their respects. A telegram was sent to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, which read, "The son of Baha has set." As Shoghi Effendi wrote in his survey of the first 100 years of Baha'i history, "With the ascension of Baha'u'llah draws to a close a period which, in many ways, is unparalleled in the world's religious history, an epoch unsurpassed in its sublimity, its fecundity, and duration by any previous dispensation had terminated." Page 33. Abdu'l-Bahá. Abdu'l-Bahá, the eldest son of Baha'u'llah, was born on the night of 23 May 1844, the same night on which the Bab declared his mission to Mulu Hussein. He was 8 when Baha'u'llah was imprisoned in Tehran. A mob sacked the family home, and they were forced into hiding for a time. Abdu'l-Bahá accompanied his parents into exile, and he recognized his father's station 10 years before Baha'u'lláh made his declaration in the Garden of Rizwan. Abdu'l-Bahá was thus the first person to believe in the mission of Baha'u'lláh. He was 9 at the time. When Baha'u'lláh left Baghdad for the mountains of Kurdistan, Abdu'l-Bahá's grief was intense. He spent much of the 2 years that Baha'u'lláh was away copying and memorizing the writings of the Bab. He was overjoyed at his father's return, and from that time onwards he was Baha'u'llah's closest companion. He never received a formal education, but learned all that he knew from Baha'u'llah. He was an active, happy person. He inherited his parents' love of nature and the countryside. His favorite sport was horse riding. On the journey from Iraq to Constantinople, Abdu'l-Bahá supervised the feeding and accommodation of the entire party of exiles. At night, he guarded his father's carriage. In Adrianople, he gradually took over the day-to-day administration of Baha'u'llah's affairs. Page 34. He began to be known as the Master, a title given him by Baha'u'llah, though after the passing of Baha'u'llah, he referred to himself simply as Abdu'l-Bahá, the servant of Bahá. He shielded his father from those who were merely curious visitors, but recognized with an extraordinary insight those who were seeking truth. He was loved by very many, and respected even by those who wished him ill. He was gentle, courteous, forgiving, generous, and unfailingly kind. In Akka, he married Munira Khanum, the daughter of 2 early followers of the Bab. The marriage was a very happy one, but of the 9 children born, 5 died. As soon as the restrictions on the prisoners began to be relaxed, Abdu'l-Bahá became a familiar figure in the mean and crowded streets of Akka. He helped everyone he could, regardless of their color, creed, and background. He went to the poorest homes where he washed and comforted the sick. His own wants were very few. He lived simply and dressed inexpensively, but his appearance was always spotless. He worked early and late and spent a large part of each night in prayer and meditation. He loved children and loved to give presents and to make people happy. My home, he said, is a home of laughter and mirth. After Baha'u'llah's passing from this life, his written will and testament was read out to his family. Abdu'l-Bahá was appointed by Baha'u'llah as the head of the Baha'i faith, and as the only authoritative interpreter of the Baha'i teachings. He called on all the Baha'is to turn to and obey Abdu'l-Bahá. Despite this clear directive, some of Baha'u'llah's own family, motivated by envy and jealousy, refused to do this. They worked steadily to destroy Abdu'l-Bahá's authority. As a result of their activities, Abdu'l-Bahá spent the years from 1901 to 1908 once again in strict confinement in Akka. In 1904 and 1907, 2 commissions were appointed by the Ottoman authorities to inquire into charges made against him. False evidence was supplied to both commissions by corrupt witnesses, and in 1907 his exile or execution was about to be recommended to the Sultan when the revolt of the Young Turks caused a change of regime in the Ottoman Empire. All political and religious prisoners of the Ottomans were set free. During these years of trouble and difficulty, Abdu'l-Bahá worked steadily on. He looked after the hungry and sick people in Akka, and he kept up an enormous correspondence with Baha'is in many countries. Page 35. In the face of persistent attacks by his own relatives, he constructed a simple stone shrine on Mount Carmel on the exact site pointed out to him by Baha'u'llah as the final resting place for the remains of the martyred Bab. As soon as he was freed from prison, Abdu'l-Bahá began to plan a journey to Europe and America. Poor health delayed his immediate departure, but in August 1911, he started on his journey to the West. He was then in his late 60s and had spent nearly 60 years in exile, some in prison, living continually with persecution and hardship. In September 1911, Abdu'l-Bahá arrived in Britain, and his first public address in the West was given at the City Temple Church in London. Page 36. During the next 2 years, he traveled in Europe and America, spreading the Baha'i teachings with the utmost wisdom and with complete devotion. Much of his time was spent in giving addresses and receiving visitors. He traveled cheaply, avoiding all ostentation and unnecessary expense. In the United States, he went from coast to coast and delivered more than 140 addresses in that country and Canada. Abdu'l-Bahá returned to Haifa in 1913. When the First World War broke out, he was once again a prisoner of the Turkish authorities. During the 4 years of isolation and danger, Abdu'l-Bahá began to organize an intensive agricultural operation near Tiberias in order to grow wheat for the people of Palestine. He continued his serene life of prayer and charity to all. As the war ended, his own life and those of his immediate family were in grave danger. The Turkish authorities threatened to crucify Abdu'l-Bahá and his family on the slopes of Mount Carmel. When news of this threat reached London, General Allenby was ordered to extend every protection and consideration to Abdu'l-Bahá. He took Haifa several days before it was believed possible for him to do so, and his cable to London read, "Have today taken Palestine, notify the world that Abdu'l-Bahá is safe." After the war was over, the British government conferred a knighthood upon Abdu'l-Bahá in recognition of his work for the peace and prosperity of the area. He accepted the honor, but never used the title. On 28 November 1921, Abdu'l-Bahá passed away in Haifa. Up to the last few days of his life, he lived and worked as he always had done, with no thought for his own rest or comfort. At his funeral, Jews, Muslims, and Christians paid tribute to him and mourned with the Baha'is their great loss in his passing. Abdu'l-Bahá's unique position. Abdu'l-Bahá occupies a unique position unknown in any previous religion. While his station was essentially a human one, he was at the same time the perfect exemplar of the Baha'i teachings and was endowed with superhuman knowledge. As the appointed successor to Baha'u'llah, he was as a stainless mirror reflecting to men the light of the manifestation of God. Under his continuous and specific instructions, the unity of the Baha'is was preserved, and the Baha'is began to build an administrative order in accordance with the outline drawn up by Baha'u'llah. In his many letters and addresses, he explained more fully the general principles drawn up by Baha'u'llah and their application in the world. Page 37. His daily life was a proof that it is possible for a human being to live a life of complete devotion to God and service to humanity under the most difficult conditions. Growth of the Baha'i faith during the lifetimes of its three central figures. During the ministry of the Bab, 1844 to 1850, his life had reached only Persia and Iraq, but from 1853 to 1892, the ministry of Baha'u'llah, the Baha'i faith, was taken to 13 other countries. The Bab and Baha'u'llah are the twin founders of this new world religion, but due to the special position of Abdu'l-Bahá as the exemplar and the center of the covenant, his writings also form part of the Baha'i scripture. From the time Baha'u'llah passed away until the death of Abdu'l-Bahá, the faith spread to another 22 countries, raising the total to 37 by the end of 1921. Page 38. Even at that early date, with the faith not even 80 years old, it could be classed as a world religion, as the countries opened included China, Burma, Australia, Russia, 8 European and 3 African countries, Brazil, Canada, and the United States of America. A tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá. Know thou of a certainty that love is the secret of God's holy dispensation, the manifestation of the All-Merciful, the fountain of spiritual outpourings. Love is heaven's kindly light, the Holy Spirit's eternal breath that vivifieth the human soul. Love is the cause of God's revelation unto man, the vital bond inherent in accordance with the divine creation and the realities of things. Love is the one means that ensureth true felicity both in this world and the next. Love is the light that guideth in darkness, the living link that uniteth God with man, that assureth the progress of every illumined soul. Love is the most great law that ruleth this mighty and heavenly cycle, the unique power that bindeth together the diverse elements of this material world, the supreme magnetic force that directeth the movements of the spheres in the celestial realms. Love revealeth with unfailing and limitless power the mysteries latent in the universe. Love is the spirit of life unto the adorned body of mankind, the establisher of true civilization in this mortal world, and the shedder of imperishable glory upon every high-aiming race and nation. Whatsoever people is graciously favored therewith by God, its name shall surely be magnified and extolled by the concourse from on high, by the company of angels and the denizens of the Abha kingdom. And whatsoever people turneth its heart away from this divine love, the revelation of the merciful, shall err grievously, shall fall into despair, and be utterly destroyed. That people shall be denied all refuge, shall become even as the vilest creatures of the earth, victims of degradation and shame. O ye beloved of the Lord, strive to become the manifestations of the love of God, the lamps of divine guidance, shining amongst the kindreds of the earth with the light of love and concord. All hail to the revealers of this glorious light. Page 39, Chapter 2, What Baha'is Believe. The Oneness of Humanity. There can be no doubt whatever that the people of the world, of whatever race or religion, derive their inspiration from one heavenly source and are the subjects of one God, Baha'u'llah. All men are the leaves and fruit of the same tree. They all have the same origin. The same rain falls upon them all. The same sun makes them grow. They are all refreshed by the same breeze. The whole of humanity is enveloped by the mercy and grace of God. As the holy writings tell us, all men are equal before God. He is no respecter of persons. Abdu'l-Bahá. The principle of the oneness of humanity is the pivot of Baha'u'llah's teachings. He explains that humanity has evolved socially through different stages of development, just as an individual human body has evolved physically through different stages of growth. In early times, men lived in isolated family groups. These family groups evolved into tribal units. Later on, these tribal units evolved into city-states and finally into nations. World unity, Baha'u'llah teaches, is the last stage in the evolution of humanity towards maturity. The purpose of his coming to earth, Baha'u'llah explains, was to enable men to become united. He wrote, "We verily have come to unite and dwell together all that dwell on earth." His teachings, he says, are for every person living on the planet, for world unity involves everyone, and no soul must be left out. The unity towards which men are evolving is not a dull uniformity, but a unity in diversity. For in the Baha'i teachings, every group of people can find the highest possible expression of their own particular ideals and aspirations. At the same time, every group or nation can share in the heritage and achievements of all the others. The glory of humanity, Abdu'l-Bahá wrote, is the heritage of each one. World unity will be built upon individual recognition of this oneness of humanity as the central spiritual principle of life today. Page 40. The unity will not be imposed from above by any powerful group, but will evolve gradually in human consciousness until men everywhere realize that the world is but one country and mankind its citizens, Baha'u'llah. This change in consciousness will lead to an organic change in society, such as the world has not yet experienced. The world civilization which will evolve will be of a richness and diversity that men can hardly at present imagine. Baha'u'llah has brought specific guidance for humanity to enable the world to pass from disunity to unity. O contending peoples and kindreds of the earth, set your faces towards unity and let the radiance of its light shine upon you. Be ye as the fingers of one hand, the members of one body. He who is your Lord, the All-Merciful, cherisheth in his heart the desire of beholding the entire human race as one soul and one body. Baha'u'llah. The Oneness of Religion. The gift of God to this enlightened age is the knowledge of the oneness of mankind and of the fundamental oneness of religion. Abdu'l-Bahá. Baha'is believe that all the great religions of the world are divine in origin. They have all been revealed by God to men in different places and different ages according to the evolving needs and capacities of the people. No age has ever been without guidance from God, and as long as there are men on earth, God will give them guidance. God himself is above and beyond human understanding. His guidance is given to men through his messengers, perfect and stainless souls, who are referred to as manifestations of God. The manifestations of God are not God themselves, but they are like perfect mirrors reflecting the light of God to men. They are like the rays of the sun which transmit the light of the sun to earth. They are intermediaries between God and humanity. They reflect in their lives and teachings the perfections of God. Through these manifestations, God causes man to know and to love him. Knowledge of God is only possible for man through these manifestations, and the knowledge of their perfections is the fullest knowledge of God to which finite minds can attain. Page 41. As a token of his mercy, and as a proof of his loving kindness, he hath manifested unto men the day stars of his divine guidance, the symbols of his divine unity, and hath ordained the knowledge of these sanctified beings to be identical with the knowledge of his own self. Baha'u'llah. The appearance of a manifestation of God on earth is so rare an event in human history that we only have the names of a few: Krishna, Abraham, Zoroaster, Moses, Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, the Bab, and Baha'u'llah. Each one of them has founded a religion and inspired a civilization. Each one was bitterly opposed, ridiculed, scorned, and ill-treated by the people among whom they first appeared. Only a few of their contemporaries recognized their station. Gradually, other men grew to recognize them. After their life on earth was over, they were, and still are, loved, revered, and followed by millions. Alone and unaided by any earthly power, they established their sovereignty over the hearts of men. They are the true educators of humanity, whose purpose is to draw men ever nearer to God and to assist in the advancement of human civilization. Baha'u'llah has explained clearly the dual station of the manifestations of God, which past ages have found so confusing. Each manifestation has a divine station. Each and every one has been endowed with all the attributes of God. They can, therefore, be regarded as one soul and the same person. If thou wilt observe with discriminating eyes, thou wilt behold them all abiding in the same tabernacle, soaring in the same heaven, seated upon the same throne, uttering the same speech, and proclaiming the same faith. Such is the unity of those essences of being. Baha'u'llah. At the same time, each manifestation has a distinct individuality and appears in this world as a human person, different in appearance, background, and personality to any that have lived on earth before. Each time such a manifestation appears on earth, it is as if the spirit of all the former manifestations return with him. He builds on what the previous manifestations have taught, brings a new message which is particularly appropriate to the age in which he appears, and looks forward to the coming of the next manifestation. As they appear as men among other men, mankind is able to exercise free will in choosing whether or not to recognize the manifestation of God for each age. Page 42. Baha'is, therefore, revere all the founders of the world's religions and regard the scriptures of all the world's religions as sacred. Baha'u'llah, Baha'is believe, is the latest of these messengers to appear on earth. He explains that every religion is made up of two parts, the spiritual teachings and the social teachings. On the higher spiritual level, there is a wonderful harmony between all the great religions. The differences exist at a social level and are about religious practices, laws, and observances. Baha'u'llah explains that the social aspect of religion are not eternal and unchanging, but that they change in every age according to the needs of the people. Differences also arise within and between different religions as a result of man-made additions to the original teachings. The purity of the message becomes distorted by the followers. It is for this reason that God sends another messenger to renew and develop the spiritual message previously given. The outward, material aspects of every religion go through stages of birth, growth, and decay. When the period of decay is reached, a new seed is planted in the hearts of men by a new messenger, and a new growth begins. Baha'u'llah's mission is to bring about unity among the religions of the world. Religion, he teaches, is the foremost agency for the peace and orderly progress of the world. World peace will involve a worldwide renewal of religion. Elimination of prejudice. Prejudice, whether of religion, race, class, nation, and color, has been and still is the most fertile cause of war. All the divisions, hatred, and warfare in the world are caused by one or other of these prejudices. The true remedy of such prejudices is the consciousness of the oneness of mankind. Once a person has gained a spiritual awareness of the unity of mankind, he can overcome his own personal prejudices. Baha'u'llah tells us that we should regard the different races and nations with the eye of oneness. Verily, the words which have descended from the heaven of the will of God are the source of unity and harmony for the world. Close your eyes to racial differences and welcome all with the light of oneness. We desire but the good of the world and the happiness of the nations, that all nations should become one in faith and all men as brothers. Page 43. That the bonds of affection and unity between the sons of men should be strengthened, that diversity of religion should cease, and differences of race be annulled. Baha'u'llah. Abdu'l-Bahá wrote, "In the estimation of God there is no distinction of color. All are one in color and beauty of servitude to Him. Color is not important. The heart is all important. It mattereth not what the exterior may be, if the heart is pure and white within. God doth not behold differences of hue and a complexion. He looketh at the hearts. He whose morals and virtues are praiseworthy is preferred in the presence of God. He who is devoted to the kingdom is most beloved. In the realm of Genesis and creation, the question of color is of least importance. Consider the flowers of a garden, though differing in kind, color, form, and shape, yet inasmuch as they are refreshed by the waters of one spring, revived by the breath of one wind, invigorated by the rays of one sun, this diversity increaseth their charm and addeth unto their beauty." Harmony of Religion and Science. Baha'u'llah teaches that religion and science are in harmony with one another. True religion and true science have never contradicted each other. They are complementary aspects of one truth. Both are progressive. Religion is gradually revealed to man by God. Man gradually discovers the mysteries of science through his own powers of investigation. Both forces are needed by man. Religion is the aid he needs for his spiritual growth. Science is the means by which he can advance materially. Religion and science are described by Baha'u'llah as the two most potent forces in the world of existence. Religion and science are the two wings upon which man's intelligence can soar into the heights with which the human soul can progress. It is not possible to fly with one wing alone. Should a man try to fly with the wing of religion alone, he would quickly fall into the quagmire of superstition. Whilst, on the other hand, with the wing of science alone, he would also make no progress, but fall into the despairing sloth of materialism. Abdu'l-Bahá. Page 44. True civilization will become a reality on earth when men realize their need for both religion and science. Both the founders of religions and the pioneers of science have suffered scorn and denial from their contemporaries. Conflict has arisen among their followers as a result of human error, usually caused by ignorance and prejudice. Religion and science walk hand in hand, and any religion contrary to science is not the truth. Abdu'l-Bahá. It is interesting in the light of the Baha'i teachings to find that the most recent advances in science emphasize the oneness of the entire universe and the interdependence of all created things. Page 45. Independent Investigation into Truth. Baha'u'llah does not wish anyone to accept his revelation blindly. He asks each individual to look into it for himself, to use his own ears and eyes, his own faculty of reasoning, and to make up his own mind. This is the first time in human history that the independent search for truth has been a practical possibility. As more people learn to read and write, they will be able to decide for themselves about the truth or falsity of Baha'u'llah's claim. It would no longer be necessary, as it has been in the past, for a certain group of people to present the religion to the rest. Genuine independent investigation demands of men much more than a blind acceptance of a faith taught by someone else. Baha'u'llah explains that each person must detach himself from inherited belief and prejudice. He must abandon, at the outset, the idea that he is right and everyone else is wrong. When you meet those whose opinions differ from your own, do not turn away your face from them. All are seeking truth, and there are many roads leading thereto. Do not allow differences of opinion or diversity of thought to separate you from your fellow men, or to be the cause of dispute. Rather, search diligently for the truth and make all men your friends. Abdu'l-Bahá. A genuine search for truth by all men will lead to unity. Truth is one in all the religions, and by means of it the unity of the world can be realized. If only men would search out truth, they would find themselves united. Abdu'l-Baha. The nature of God. Baha'u'llah teaches that man's finite mind will never understand God, for the finite cannot comprehend the infinite. It is like expecting a table to have an intellectual understanding of the mind of the carpenter who made it. Abdu'l-Baha wrote, "Man cannot grasp the essence of divinity, but can by his reasoning power, by observation, by his intuitive faculties, and the revealing power of his faith, believe in God, discover the bounties of his grace." While men cannot understand the essential nature of God, they can be certain that the divine really exists. Page 46. "Regard thou the one true God as one who is apart from and immeasurably exalted above all created things. The whole universe reflecteth his glory, while he is himself independent of and transcendeth his creatures. This is the true meaning of divine unity. He who is the eternal truth is the one power who exerciseth undisputed sovereignty over the world of being, whose image is reflected in the mirror of the entire creation. All existence is dependent upon him, and from him is derived the source of the sustenance of all things." Baha'u'llah. God is to be regarded as the fashioner of the universe. He is at the same time a personal loving father to every human being who has ever lived and will ever live. The combination of these two roles is almost beyond the grasp of man, but this is what has been taught by the founder of every religion. Each one has extolled the greatness of God, and each one has taught that God has a purpose and a great love for every human being. These founders of religion, the manifestations, are the link between God and man. Baha'u'llah refers to them as luminous gems of holiness which appear out of the realm of the spirit in the noble form of the human temple, made manifest unto all men, that they may impart unto the world the mysteries of the unchangeable being and tell of the subtleties of his imperishable essence. Men can learn more of God and draw nearer to him by turning to these manifestations. Baha'u'llah wrote, "So perfect and comprehensive is his creation that no mind nor heart, however keen or pure, can ever grasp the nature of the most insignificant of his creatures, much less fathom the mystery of him who is the day star of truth, who is the invisible and unknowable essence. The conceptions of the devoutest of mystics, the attainments of the most accomplished among men, the highest praise which human tongue or pen can render, are all the product of man's finite mind and are conditioned by its limitations. From time immemorial he hath been veiled in the ineffable sanctity of his exalted self, and will everlastingly continue to be wrapped in the impenetrable mystery of his unknowable essence." Page 47. "Every attempt to attain to an understanding of his inaccessible reality hath ended in complete bewilderment, and every effort to approach his exalted self and envision his essence hath resulted in hopelessness and failure." Baha'u'llah. This is the end of side 2 on tape 1, ending on page 47. Please go to the next tape for a continuation.